How you doing? Today, we are very happy to have some data concerning a very old subject. So, with your permission, we'll just sail right into the lecture. Some terrifically new fundamentals have just dropped into our lap, which are very well worth examining. As you know, Scientology is a body of knowledge devoted to the improvement of human ability. More than that, it is a study of life forces, life sources, a general study of what life in the universe is, and is calculated to blow wide open a few mysteries that people have been sitting on for a few thousand years. And it's our contention that they have had enough fun with these mysteries and that they've derived enough revenue from them and that everything now can be exposed. In the general study of the world and its affairs, we find out the only way that you can make a slave, as if anybody'd want one, would be to develop a tremendous amount of mystery about what it's all about. And then develop an overwhelming charge on the mystery line. You know, not only develop the mystery, but then sell it real good. Sell some bogus answer to the mystery. Man is so used to this that when you come along and put a perfectly good answer in his hands, well, he drops it like a hot potato. As he knows what all answers are. All answers are carefully derived from mysteries with bogus answers. And that all mysteries are going to cost you something sooner or later. Now, the development of a mystery itself stems from interpersonal relationships and man's general conflict with his fellows and his environment and so on. And the basic mystery is, who is he? That's the basic mystery. There's no more basic mystery than that. Who is that fellow over there? Who are those people over there? Which is the beginning of individuation.
Of not individualism, but individuation. Of pulling back from everybody and saying, I am me and they are them and God knows what they're up to. And then after a while, the fellow takes it out of the realm of mere blasphemy and puts it into worship. And he says, well, God knows what they're up to, and he will protect me. So what do we basically have? We basically have a mystery on who the other fellow is. Now, science, quote unquote. Science originally meant truth, and now it means research revenue. Science has so far abandoned the basic mystery that they think there's a mystery on what that is. What is the floor? What is the ceiling? What is space? You see?
That's the big mystery.
Well, that's really a very cooked up mystery. Because that floor and that ceiling and that space is what thee and me agreed to put there. That's about all it is. If you don't believe this, get run on a process sometimes, which as is the walls. The next thing you know, you're looking through them. Because you're not putting them there. And if you're ever in a very high skyscraper someplace or another, don't run the process on the floors. Now, wherever we have a mystery, we normally basically had a disagreement or a misunderstanding or an out of communication net. And that's actually all there is to it. That's all you had, basically. Fellow didn't agree with who he was looking at. See, he knew about it originally. And he didn't want to know who that fellow was over there. He didn't want to know anything about the situation because if he had learned a lesson, if he communicated with it, he would be proved wrong. So we did have some people in our midst, you amongst them, who would put up a this and say it was a that, and then get these things twisted somehow or another, and you'd say, now why don't you communicate with this? And then say, well, you communicated with that. After a while, it says, I don't want to communicate with either one of them. Dickens with it. Who cares what those things are? I don't want to know. And after that, he'd had it. He said, I don't want to know. Therefore, he had a mystery sitting across from him somewhere. And he went so far along this line of not wanting to know that after a while, he conceived that he didn't know. And then he went from there and said, it's impossible to know. And wrote endless books down in Königsberg and signed his name Can't Know. Now, wherever man finds himself deeply instilled and engrossed, surrounded with mystery, he is actually in conflict with himself and himself alone. That is why processing works. The only aberration is denial of self. Nobody else can do anything to you but you. That's a horrible state of affairs. You can do something to you, but it requires your postulate, your agreement or your disagreement before anything could happen to you. People have to agree to be ill. They have to agree to be stupid. They have to agree to be a mystery, and actually, early on the track, did agree to being hornswoggled. Now, people, then, are the victims of their own flinch. The victims of their own postulate. The victims of their own belief that they are inadequate. Processing wouldn't work if this weren't true. If you believe this thing needs a proof. It's a very remarkable thing that you can take one individual all by himself and straighten him out. Although the mystic will tell you that you have to straighten out the whole universe before you can be straightened out. That's not true at all. You would simply be, to be technical, loused up on the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth dynamics. But you could be straightened out, even on those dynamics, without recourse to those dynamics. And the reason for that is simply this, that an individual has to postulate into existence his own aberration, his own flinch, his own stupidity, his own inadequacy, his own lack of confidence, and his own bad luck. These things are self-evident. When you process an individual, you can change his position on the tone scale, you can change his position on any profile, graph, test, reaction meter, you can change his basic health, and so forth. Well, you couldn't do any of these things at all if somebody else was interfering. It is the feeling that somebody else has interfered that is the most deadly postulate. That somebody else is making it so brings about the feeling that one is not responsible for one's own condition. And we get shame, blame, and regret, other things of that character. How did an individual feel in the first place that something could be done to his own postulates or that he could be moved in on by somebody else. He had to consent to it. He had to consent to his postulates being wrong. He had to consent to the fact that somebody could mix up his own postulates. That he had to consent to. He had to say, well, somebody can mix up a postulate. Somebody else can keep it from arriving. He had to say that. Well, there's very interesting mechanisms on the back track. Very, very interesting. Very intricate. By which he then says, I can no longer make a postulate in that direction. Well, he had to say that somebody else had a right to mess up his postulate. He had to say that somebody else could interfere with what he wanted to have happen. And the trick is, these two are one's own postulates. Fascinating, isn't it? The postulate that somebody else can interfere with one's postulates is made by oneself, not by somebody else. Wherever you get a series of postulates which are aimed toward failure, they don't get made. They hang out here someplace, and you get a reactive bank. There's a series of postulates, but they never arrive. They never accomplish anything. Therefore, they simply go on to wait. And all of these waiting postulates and waiting ideas and waiting mechanisms and so on are apparently, of course, suspended right in present time all the time. And so you get a reactive mind, an unconscious mind, they used to call it, a reconscious, subconscious mind. And that thing then can sail along on the time track because all these postulates are on wait to arrive. There are other reasons they're there. That is, one says, gives out with a postulate or gives out with a thought and then says, it isn't my thought. He denies that it was his thought. In other words, he becomes irresponsible for the thought that he thought. And having become irresponsible for it, nobody owns it. Oh, look, there's nobody else around that's going to do anything with the thought but you. And if you have a thought in your bank that is still there, nobody can do anything about it but you. All an auditor can do is direct your attention toward it. But that's all he can do. It'd be you who spotted it, you who picked it up, you who assisted it, you who changed it. Now, this is an awful lot of responsibility for somebody to swallow all at one fell gulp. That's a lot of responsibility, and people are very unwilling to take that much responsibility. They say, I couldn't possibly be responsible for all of that. That's another way of making a mystery. One says, he does something, he isn't responsible for it, he says, therefore nobody's responsible for it, but it still is. You get a government. See? You get a mystery sitting out there, which apparently has some force or power. It has some existence. It apparently could do something. So then one makes further postulates to defend oneself against this mystery which one made in the first place. Confusing, isn't it? I'm sure you found it so. But let's get back to a basic mechanism that I think you would like to know about. Clear back to Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health, a basic principle of existence survive. A re-examination of that principle recently gave us a great many new processes. Excuse me, I'm in America. Processes. Gave us a great deal of new understanding of all of this and gave us a much greater speed of action in processing. So we're right back to fundamentals. What new thing could possibly be found out about survival? Actually, it's so idiotically simple that you all knew it all the time. And at least 12 people will tell me immediately after this lecture, that's certainly true, I've thought that every now and then. Why didn't you tell me before? It works like this. Recently, I made a series of investigations into disease. Illness, disease, so forth. What is this thing called illness? What is this thing called disease? How does it happen? If the plant itself had to agree to being sick, then the disease must somehow or other be generated by the plant. Now, some of our basic experiments, by the way, were done on bacteria. The strange fact that bacteria can remember. They can remember through several generations. Those experiments were done a number of years ago. About 13, 14 years ago, to be exact. And they consist of blowing cigarette smoke and blowing white steam, which exactly resembled it, over a body of bacteria and inspecting it through microscopes and photomicrography. 3 generations later, the bacteria which had dodged from the nicotine which had injured it then was mistaken for steam. In other words, you blew steam on it. It remembered having been hurt by nicotine. And it ran, it died, it behaved just as though it had just had nicotine smoke blown on it. Got the idea? That was actually the first discovery of the engram and the key-in. And that's what demonstrates it. And some great biologist someday can repeat these experiments and make a name for himself. Bacterial memory. Terribly interesting stuff. Because bacteria divides. Its second dynamic is total division. And the discovery that its memory went up the track with it, generation by generation, was terribly fascinating. We know now what that would be. I didn't know then quite what that was. I merely knew that these things were remembering everything they had known. But I was still dealing in the dark ages of biology, and I thought that living things were living tissue. And they aren't. You see, they're theta. They're Satan, any bacterial thing. And what they were doing was simply skipping generations up the line, you see. And I remembered what had happened a few generations ago. And it says, uh-oh, more cigarette smoke, you see. And it said, well, I die now. Bye, folks. It didn't need the impulse to kill before it died. See, it didn't actually need the poison before it kicked the bucket. Now, we have to assume now that dying is a voluntary, if reactive, action. And that all death and all obliteration of identity attempted through the action of death is the result of a voluntary postulate. Now, this operating reactively is, of course, below the level of awareness of the person, and he is actually acting on decisions to die which were made a long time ago. They run something like this. Well, if black fish ever show up again, I'll just have to die quick because they hurt too much. And one day, some little kid comes along with a plastic fish and shows it to this guy. He promptly goes home and tries to die. It sounds irrational almost, you see. But that's what he does. Let's say he was a harpooner running out of some New England port, and he got in the midst of a bunch of grampus, and they chomped him up and chewed him up, and he finally climbed onto some raft or something. He floated around wounded for 4 or 5 days, and it was uncomfortable. He makes a postulate about that time.
Boy, those grampus, they're bad things. And if they ever show up again, the thing to do is just kick off right now. Don't wait around for the feast. Little kid comes along, shows him a model grampus. He says, well, I've had it. Reactively, okay? The postulate's waiting there. You see, he doesn't trust himself to make the proper decision, so he buries the proper decision based on experiment and experience somewhere over that way. And it's supposed to trigger off and go off like a well-oiled bomb when the right stimuli appears. This all stems from self-distrust, invalidation of self, and so forth. Well, when he gets home, there's the wife, and there's the kids, and there's his job, and there's his responsibilities for this and his that and so forth, and it wouldn't be a nice thing to die at this time. It would be an overt act against everybody if he just suddenly, you know, just parked the body and shoved off. There's penalties against dying. One mustn't die. And the postulate goes into action anyway. The postulate occurs, and, well, he's got to die, he can't die. He's got to die, he's got to live. And this really gets him. Now, the conflict isn't what makes him sick. That isn't what happens. He's decided to die in such a way that he won't be responsible for the action of dying. He's supposed to die because, you know, nobody can live with a black fish around. He's supposed to die, but the society says, live! Get healthy, eat vitamins, see your doctor, brush your dentist 3 times a week. And the answer to that is covert dying. And that's all that disease, germs, psychosomatics, accidents, explosions, and joining the army amount to. The whole works. That's covert dying because the society won't let them die straight out. And there's nobody anywhere that is ill that isn't doing covert dying. Now, let's look at the series of experiments which brought this about. At HCO St. Hill, I was posed with an economic problem of considerable interest, actually interest to all of us. I decided to make research free. It was necessary to make its compilation an accomplished fact and free. In other words, we had to free it from incoming lines as nearly as possible. The compilation of data, tabulation, and so forth, this has to be done now. But to ask everybody to pay the bill after they really did pay the bill, way on up the line, it means it's a long job. It's a 10, 12, 15-year job at any guess. And I decided to solve it by making the unit, HCO St. Hill, which is HCO WW, solvent from another economic quarter. So I went to work. I won't bore you with a long story, but I don't care what I research. And I decided that if this thing were to really get whizzing, then the thing to do was to produce something which wouldn't even upset the market at all, which didn't require any selling, which everybody wanted, which everybody needed, they all had to have, and then produce that in a sufficient quantity to get together 50,000 pounds a year. Gross. You see? That's about $139,000 or something like that a year. That gives enough to get a staff and some secretaries and get the thing wheeling. Well, I needed then a 50,000 pound a year growth, and most people marketing and selling and running a business or doing something like that, they operate on a 10, 15% profit. Well, of course, 10 or 15% of 15 or 50,000 pounds a year is not enough to pay for that office. So here's a brand new way of looking at a business, although somebody will tell me it's an old way. You take a product that doesn't require selling because everybody uses it. You simply produce it at a gross figure which doesn't disturb the market any. And then you take its cost of production and carve it on down to just as close to zero as you possibly can. That is the operating margin you're working on. Economical and rapid production of the thing, rather than trying to make it fancy or better or sell it harder or so forth. Just relax that level, you think. And instead of having your profit margin be just that much, you see, I mean, it's just the difference between this and this, have your profit margin be this much of this total, see? You know, produce the thing for about 30%. Well, that gives you a 70% profit margin. And all you have to do then is just figure ways to gear up, speed up, assembly lines, square around, and so forth. So I tacked this problem, went in weekends, come down from London, knock it around, straighten it up, and so forth. Next thing you know, I had South American popcorn growing out of the ground like this. You could practically watch it grow, see? British gardeners around there saying, oh, the things you're doing, that's all wrong. You mustn't have that sort of a vine house, you see. You mustn't handle glass houses in this fashion and all of this sort of thing. And they didn't know why I'd get so cheerful every time they told me this. Because they were telling me that whatever improvements I made in production of this particular installation would not be copied. Which would hold the market clear up here where I wanted it. I didn't want everybody to suddenly be able to produce tomatoes and squash and so forth all bing, 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 like this. No, only this one plant should produce them that fast and we'd still have that margin. I was not interested in the economics of it with any personal interest at all, but it certainly did cheer me up. They'd come around and they'd say, God, this is hot in here. I say, get your breath. No plant can live. They were all in the valences of plants, you see. They knew they couldn't live in this atmosphere, so therefore plants couldn't live in this atmosphere. Well, a market gardener takes about 15%. Takes about 15% of his profit and has to charge it off to diseased or failed plants. So you understand, I was looking for margin. See, I was looking for margin. Any section of 15% was very well worth looking at. American assembly line method, wonderful. That takes a nice chunk, see? Not too many handling. Cutting down the heat bill, cutting down this, cutting down that. There are all these little slices here which gave us more and more product. And disease was a nice chunk here. So I said, well, I'm the old expert in Scientology. Let's see what we can do with plant disease, you know? Boom! Got in there and threw plants around in all directions and made some plants sick to make them well. And boy, they didn't get well. And then I found out I was studying the wrong end of it. I had to study what made plants sick. And the next thing you know, I was right back in the lap of Scientology. We'd just done some more basic research and I hadn't even noticed it. You evidently, from this series of experiments, cannot make a plant sick which has not had continuous, repeated shocks. And if you take a plant, you took the seed, good seed, the seed has been growing for many generations, and everything is all fine. And you took this seed, particularly around market seed production units. They don't pay any attention to plants. They just let them grow, thank God. They just let them grow. They don't do anything much to them when they get up to total fruiting and so forth. Why, they go out there, reap them all down, rescue the seed out of them, put it in the bins properly, and that's all. Market gardeners do tremendous things to plants to make them produce. But these seed fellows don't do anything, so the seeds are usually pretty good.
Take these seeds,
put it in the pot, let it grow, germinate, and then put a dryer on it. You know, dry it out. Dry it out real good. And then pour the water to it. Pour the water to it, you know. Get, oh, man, you know. Now a little plant grow, and everything's going to be all right. Now a little plant, and just up a little further. Pick it up, transplant it. It says, boom. It says, I've had it. You say, oh, no, little plant, you haven't had it. Grow, grow now. Here's fertilizer, and here's the B1, and you're all set. Grow now. That's right. Are you growing all right now? Well, we've got too many leaves. Now, isn't that better? Isn't that more comfortable? Cooler. Cooler. It grows more leaves. And then one day, somebody happens to close pruning shears near it, or rattle a watering can somewhere in its vicinity, and it gets spot, mildew, cutworm, anything it can get. It says, I'm on my way. Now, proper market action at this time is to get the spray, you know, spray. You know, real heady. Dig the soil up around the roots and shove chemical in it, you know. They're saying, live. And this plant says, the hell with it. So I've had it. Can't get me in like that. But it says, I'll fool you. I'll start to produce some fruit, you know. You say, oh, wonderful, the plot, the whole thing recovered, and everything's going to be fine now, and so forth. And the fruit suddenly goes black, rotten, and falls off. Plop. Disease. Now, here's another interesting test. The plant, which was planted at the same time, and wasn't shocked with dryness, and then shocked with wetness, and then shocked with dryness and wetness, wasn't transplanted, wasn't trimmed, just went right on growing and grew fruit, and that was it. Now we take this plant, we take the diseased plant, and we put them right together. And we say, go on, plant. You were the one that was planted and grown fruit and everything. Get sick. Go on, get sick. Just hell with it. Why should I get sick? You say, well, look how sick he is. He said, no, I'm doing all right. Everything's fine. Doing all right. He said, but look, this stuff he's got's contagious. Gets to anybody. Anything. Well, you keep this up for quite a while. And nothing happens unless you take this plant, so far not shocked, and give it a couple of quick ones. Oh, you drop a couple of 240-volt terminals in it and something like this and take them out. Now it says, boy, there's a victim over there. This is the way I'm a victim. Fine. Black spot, mildew, rot. Where are the cutworms, eelworms, wireworms? Bring them on. And he gets sick. We've all watched the phenomenon of a physician or a nurse, something like that, taking care of tremendous numbers of sick people and never getting these illnesses. Well, if it's a simple matter of taking a bacterii, whatever it is, and bringing it over here and introducing it to somebody else and always having him get sick, if that were an invariable experiment, then we could believe the medicos. But unfortunately for them, their experiments are not invariable. You can take a horse syringe full of something and shoot it into a fellow who is just having a ball, you know, in life. You let him have it. He says, what was that? Oh, it's disease. You're going to get sick now, and so forth. He says, give me that. Goes on about his business. Then some fine day, why, we beat him up, turn him over to the psychiatrist, make him pay his income tax. And we take a millionth to the cc of this stuff, see? And we say, oh, he says, I've had it. I'm dead. I'm dying. Get the idea? The basic postulate, in other words, as tends to be demonstrated by these plant experiments, is that the plant must be of a mind to die before it can get sick. I've even gone so far as to take a plant, now just in the last many weeks, take a plant that was perfectly healthy and was carefully raised with no shock of any kind. Another plant over here, which had it, take a cutworm and put him on the first plant, the healthy one. Cutworm says, because I don't believe it. This is too easy. And he jumps over to the disease plant and eats it. There's some mysterious factor involved. Now, evidently, cutworms like diseased plants or something of the sort, but they don't easily chew up healthy ones. A plant has to have had a number of traumatic experiences before it decides it isn't worth it and it had better kick off and find a new generation of activity. And that's disease. That's illness. And a person who gets repeatedly ill is evidently doing the same thing. Now, you understand I'm talking to you about theory. I'm not talking to you about actual practice. But at the same time, we could make this series of experiments very easily on people. And since that time, I have done this. All I've done, however, is pick up the conscious survival postulate for the individual to see and leave alone the injuries. To leave alone the actual impact, the old Dianetic traumas. Just pick up those postulates to die. Pick them up. This is an old experiment, by the way. It isn't a recent one at all. Pick up those postulates to die and have the individual get better from these impacts. See, we already knew that this existed. Now, what we needed, actually, what we needed desperately, was a process which picked up each and every facet of this sort of thing. Now, a plant running on the track as any other life form must have a similar background, should have. People have to decide very early that there's something wrong with communicating over to that before they can get an obsessive effect from that. Now, this is an interesting thing. It isn't that they communicate over to that and then it communicating back ruins them. They get the idea after a while that this is the case, but it's never the case. They're communicating to this, then permits it to communicate back and so ruins them. For instance, one says, well, if he never went around and saw a man with a cold, or never ran into a man with a cold, or never communicated with a man with a cold, he would, of course, never have a cold. That's my old friend Louis Pasteur. He's quite a guy, Louis Pasteur. Talked to him once in Paris. And we thought he was very new, novel, and strange. Matter of fact, he was a prisoner during the Franco-Prussian War, and we interrogated him. But the idea that a diseased germ could simply at will wander over and settle on anybody and then that anybody would die, or that bacteria would have a beneficial or a bad reaction on wine and so forth, that was pasteuritis. And if you never let any germs exist, then nobody ever got sick. That was the theory. Let's look at that theory now in the light of modern findings, and we'll find that pasteurizing milk and preventing the germs from getting any place is just another forcer saying, live, live. Got the idea? That's just another one. You mustn't die. That makes it just that much harder for a fellow who is trying to kick the bucket to kick the bucket. See? It's actually an overt act, if you want to look at it factually. Yet we have health departments and smelt departments running around all over the place saying, your milk pasteurized? Well, here's a warrant. Oh, Louis Pasteur had a ball. He's a good man. He's a good man. He's selling groceries someplace now. Anyhow. The germ theory of disease has never been invalidated on the basis that when you carried a bacteriae from here to here, it would not make the new here sick. See, that's factual. But nobody ever investigated the undercrust of all this mechanism. The new here had to want to get sick and had to accept that bacteriae to its bosom and had to say, boy, I can manufacture plenty of this. And these guys that have been making me live, I'll have fooled them. Got the idea? In other words, it was welcome. That's never been investigated. Why the bacteria got things sick? All that's been investigated is how to get it relayed, how to stop it from getting relayed, and that it did make people sick. That's where the investigation stopped. Well, we can't be quite that superficial in Scientology. We'd never be where we are. So, investigated the whole undercurrent of this on the basis of survival. So, contra-survival postulates are, of course, the reason for contra-survival. But a contra-survival postulate, a succumb postulate, in other words, isn't anything more than I'll try again. See, I'll cease to be where I am right now, and I'll try it again. See? Until somebody comes along and gives them an enforced survival postulate. A fellow's got a contra-survival postulate. Says, well, first opportunity here, I'll shed this old snake skin, and I'll pick up a new one and go roaring up the track, maybe have a better crack at it. Guy over here says, oh, no, you don't. No, you don't. You are going to live. We've got scalpels.
We've got sutures. We've got this-is, that-is, and Listerine, and you're going to live. And that's it. You're going to live. The fella said, nah. I gotta kick the bucket, I'll show you. No, no, you're gonna live, son. That's all there is to it. If you don't, and we ever find out about it, and catch you again somewhere along the line, ha! Wow. Well, the fellow says, well, I'm gonna succumb anyway. The other fellow says, well, you know, if you succumb, it's a very hard job to succumb. This is very difficult. It's very difficult. And I insist that you survive. And if you don't survive, I'm going to be awful mad. So the fellow's going to succumb. He's already in his succumb frame of mind. And he pulls out a ray gun or a glare fight or something of the sort. And he says, boom! And he tries to knock off this fellow that's messing up his postulates. The fellow messing off the postulates says, I'll show him. See? So he says, oh, oh, oh! Agony, agony.
says, oh, my wife, my children. Oh, God, what have you done? Victim, 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 victim.
What's he doing?
He's simply saying, you see how hard it is to succumb? See, it's real hard to succumb. It's agony. And the thing wrong with dying, you will all admit, is that it's so difficultly painful. Isn't that right? Did you ever try to hold your breath so your body'd kick the bucket? You never seem to make it. And this is the way the game of victim originates. The succumb postulate met by a survive postulate. And all a survive postulate can do is set an example that it's best to survive because it is so painful to succumb. That's it. It's so painful to succumb that one had better survive in spite of anything. You get an elephant. You get a turtle. I don't know what the turtles did on their line or what conversations went on about survive and succumb on the turtle line. But if you've ever tried to kill a turtle, you'll know what I'm talking about. You can cut off his feet and his head and bung him out of the shell, and he's still screaming. That's right. You can chop him up and put him in the stew pot, and he still yells. Man, he's convinced. He's convinced. Then you'd say that a man in good shape, sounds funny, but it's true, but a man in good shape could die just like that, bang. See? Because dying is a game whereby you postulate out of existence your old identity and postulate into existence a new identity. And you're doing the total act of dying, girls, when you simply dye your hair. See? It's the total act. You're saying, well, away with this old identity, on with a bright, shiny, glamorous new. And that's basically what dying is. But it's become so much a vested interest on the part of police forces and others to have identity remain constant as long as possible. It permits them to keep a tab on everybody and everything, you see. Identity must remain constant, on and forever. As a control mechanism or a slavery mechanism. And everybody, to some slight degree, works at this because we don't like to see our friends disappear. And it's an irresponsible thing for a friend to disappear. And we invent all kinds of rationale why he shouldn't disappear, why he should stick around, you know. The truth of the matter is the whole of dying is as simple as, I am no longer John Jones, I am now Bill Smith. That's all. Right? But pretty soon, in order to make this stick, you have to take the body you've got, see? You got to knock it to pieces and make it impossible to use anymore and mess it up, get it in the grave, fill it full of worms. You know, before you think you have a right, now you're enough of a victim, before you have enough of a right to come back, you see, and pick up a brand new body and say, well, I'm Bill Smith, I'm Mary Smith, whatever the case may be, here I am. Never lived before. Never. No. Never did. Chicago bank robbery? Never heard of it. Bankruptcy? Never heard of it. No. Now, what was actually a game became a mechanism to keep people from confronting things. And an individual, when he found out that, well, he just didn't want to confront things anymore, best thing he could do was kick the bucket. And we had a social mechanism all rigged up where it said it was perfectly permissible for him not to confront anything anymore. Don't think that isn't a gag. If you don't confront things anymore, you've had it. Because the fellow over there has become a total mystery to you. Because you say that's one direction we can never look. It is the mystery, the uncertainty,
stemming out of a refusal to look and know and understand, which brings one about into the use of a mechanism of I am now somebody else, and the old individuality doesn't have to look anymore at all, ever. I'm now some bright new person, and I'm looking all new and fresh, and everything is fine. The only thing wrong with it, it's a damn lie. And every succumb postulate that a fellow ever made is waiting someplace, if it was not totally effective. It's just waiting. Say, well, you'll see a black grampus one of these days. Then we'll have at it. You understand? Those things still wait around. So here's some fellow. Now we get into the mystery of here's some fellow with everything to live for. Everything. He just going up the track on a big roar. Got Cadillacs and girlfriends and a new wife. He got everything. All of a sudden, he goes down the freeway and just doesn't turn. He just keeps going. And this is so inexplicable that we have all agreed that it's bad luck and he had nothing to do with it. We'll still leave people that hole to climb out of. Now, something happened just before that that showed him a black grampus. And you'll find out that there was, even in present time, a slight desire to knock it off. There must have been some slight desire. The wife objected to the girlfriend, something nonsensical. But it made him feel he'd better charge at it again. When a person has it made totally across the boards and they're not upset at all, it's pretty hard to make them sick. But if they've got it made across the boards and don't want any part of it, it's awful easy to make them sick. So your objective view of whether a fellow is well off or bad off is invalid until actually you yourselves have looked to find out what his idea of it is. And his idea of plastic cars and mink coats might possibly be entirely different than what it should be or was socially, publicly acceptable. And he may be crawling around in 1776 still shooting at the British, see? And well knowing that he'd better not be traitor to the king. He's never got over it, never got out of it. Situation still was mishmashed. He didn't understand it. He was on the wrong side. He didn't know quite what he was doing. He had it all... it was confusing. Mystery. Didn't know about it. Best thing to do in a case of mystery, obviously, is don't confront it anymore and go and be somebody else. Oh, but every time somebody does that, the mystery's still there. Still right there. One day, he's walking down the street, feeling fine. He turns around the corner and runs, boom! He says, my God, what was that? What was that? Well, that was a mystery which he failed to confront someplace. And the total composite of all mysteries is the total of things one didn't confront on that subject. The total of stupidity is the total of all things that one refused to look at on that subject. And one after a while, pretty stupid. No data. If you want to get real stupid, just refuse to have any data on a subject at all. You'll get stupid. Never look at any part of it. Never look at any slightest part of something and eventually become a total mystery. Or hold up to people something that can't be looked at and keep saying to them, don't you see it? That'll create a mystery too. Because there isn't anything there and they say something is there. Or there's something there and the person is saying nothing is there. And either way you get a mystery. Mysteries are generally solved by going off and not looking at them anymore, instead of looking into them and finding what was there in the first place. That's the way mysteries are normally handled these days. And that handling of a mystery we call dying. So all dying becomes a mystery. We say, well, there's too many mysteries now. It's all too unknown. I'm just a bundle of anxieties.
There's no psychotherapy can show me anything about it, so I guess the best thing for me to do is just do a little covert dialogue. Lumbago, there it is. Ha ha, boy. And they covertly die a little further and a little further and a little further and a little further, and they finally make the grade. Then they hear of a disease or read of one that's sufficiently virulent, and that's their final alibi. As a medico, you could knock off more patients by simply walking around to them, because wherever you got one sick, you've got somebody that wants to be sick, and you just walk around to them and you'd say, well, that's serious enough to kill you. Yeah. Now, if you do that sort of thing, you'll destroy your practice if you're in medicine. So your only recourse is to have the controlling interest of the local undertaking establishment. Which I think is the usual arrangement, isn't it? But to go on living requires that one penetrate the mysteries which are making him back up. And the greatest of those mysteries is the mystery of should I survive or should I succumb, or what symbols mean succumb and what symbols mean survive, and what mysteries, when they show up, mustn't be penetrated. That's the biggest mystery of all. And one gets all of these things lined up. They all add up to survive and succumb. They all add up to confront, not confront. And they all add up to all manner of oddities. Principal amongst them, however, is one very interesting fact. One very, very interesting fact that we haven't, until this time, suspected. We haven't suspected this at all right up till now. But I just found out about it just a moment ago, standing here looking at it. But you are a victim. Well, think it over for a moment. Are you a victim?
No.
Not a victim?
No.
Well, if you've never been a victim, and you never will be a victim, and if you are a victim, then you'll be a total cause, and you'll run a good HAS co-audit, and you'll live for a long time, and Scientology will get along fine. Thank you. Thank you.